Hello, Dave.
Ken.
Last time I saw you was over at the loft. You had stopped by doing research for your book, Tribal Leadership,
Yeah.
and it did come out, Tribal Leadership, Leveraging Natural Groups to Build a Thriving Organization. And I really love the book. I mean, it's simple, it's straightforward, it's based on research, but it's a how-to book, really. It's a how-to book for leaders to increase the altitude of the development of their corporate culture. And as we have in study after study is starting to show, the interiors of individuals in corporations and not just exterior stuff like systems theory and working on quality control management and all of that, the interiors are just as important, sometimes more important. And I think this is a really terrific book on how to get oriented to that interior space.
Well, thank you. Coming from you, that means a tremendous amount. And
Well, thank you. What I'd really like to do is just go through it. One of the great things about it is not only does it describe the landscape, it gives a few simple pointers on how individuals can use leverage points to help develop individuals in their culture, to help develop the culture itself,
yes.
which is great. So you start by talking about tribes and the notion that tribes are a group of people, anywhere from 20 to 150, and they're actually, in terms of what gets done in the company, they're actually more important and independent of teams and organizations and so on. So it's an extremely effective and crucial cultural component, isn't it?
Right.
So your study, 10-year study, 24,000 people, more than two dozen companies, and you conclude that the effectiveness of a company depends on the effectiveness of tribes, which can be established by effective tribal leaders. And one of the things that tribal leaders do is they understand the cultural terrain. They understand the five, in this case, five major stages of development that individuals and companies go through, and that, in a sense, teams go through. And we'll be going over these in detail, but just to name them, they are stage one, life sucks. Stage two, my life sucks. Stage three, I'm great, you're not. Stage four, we're great. Stage five, life is great. And tribes emerge from the language that people use to describe themselves, their jobs, their others, and tribal leaders know this. So tribal leaders are watching, in particular, two leverage points. One is the ways that people talk to each other, and the other is the relationships that people form. And so with those two major leverage points, you can sort of get a crowbar into these stages of development and help move stages along.
I have to say, that's probably the best summary of the book I have ever heard in 5 minutes or less.
Excellent. One of the things that I noticed, of course, is that you talk, in a sense, about the team's dominant mode of discourse. And what I've often pointed out is that there is a difference between individual hold-ons and social hold-ons, and that individual hold-ons have what Alfred North Whitehead called a dominant mode,
right,
a dominant monad. And so if my dog decides to get up and walk across the room, 100% of its molecules, cells, quarks get up and walk across the room. And it's not a democracy. It's the dominant monad is in control.
Right.
But social hold-ons don't have anything like that. Instead of a dominant monad, they have a dominant mode of discourse.
Right.
And so getting at that dominant mode of discourse is the closest thing you can do to get at the mode of control of a team and of a social hold-on.
Right.
So tribal leaders often, of those four stages, often are at stage four, but the point is they lead according to understanding all five stages. and are aware of the leverage point for all five stages and are adjusting their communication with all five stages in mind.
Right.
Most business consultants focus on only one stage and its leverage points. The more stages, the better, and you cover all five. So this is a genuinely integral or integral-like approach to business consulting, which I think, of course, you know, is terrific.
Well, thank you. And that's what we intended. So just by way of background,
yeah,
there was, of course, a tribe that put the book together. I was
right.
one of the members of it. John King has been my business partner now going on 14 years.
Yeah.
And then we picked up Haley, who's a medical doctor, actually close to you in Denver.
Right.
A few years into the study, she helped us get some interviews and do some other things. So just in terms of my background, and if John were here, he would say something different, but in terms of my background, I'm really a language scholar.
Uh-huh.
And so I spent years, for example, looking at the rhetorical discourse in World War II between Churchill and Hitler, and then examining rhetorical artifacts of Roosevelt, but really focusing on that time. It was such a profound moment in history that really
right.
could have gone either way.
Right.
And some things jumped out at us, and us being John and me, that people really hadn't seen. So once you explain the levels, as you've done briefly, and really their stages, recognizing that groups move through these stages, so a lot of leaders will immediately say, well, I don't want to have anything to do with stage really two or below.
Yeah.
My life sucks or life sucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why would I ever want to go there? Why would I ever want to talk there?
Right.
And really, I don't. Now that I see it, I don't even really want to go to stage three, which is all about me, what I think, I
right.
believe. So they're provocative or leading statements. And if you look at really any of these great speeches, they touch on at least stages two, three, four, and five.
Right.
And probably the one that just lays it out, you know, so clearly is King's I Have a Dream. You know, the line we remember, I Have a Dream, is a stage three statement.
Right.
But it begins with not the words, but essentially my life sucks or our lives suck because
right.
of the situation we find ourselves.
Right.
And then it moves to stage three, I Have a Dream. You know,
right.
very interesting. He didn't say we have a dream or there is a dream
right.
or God has sent us a dream.
Right.
But I have a dream. And then it moved up to we statements. And then finally, it ended with all-encompassing statements where no one was left out, all of
right.
God's children.
Right.
So you begin looking at this, and then you look back at, you know, as you made the point, at business, and usually leaders try to talk stage four, but really when they say we, what they mean is I. So
yeah.
it's even an inauthentic form of we.
Right.
And so it really loses everyone, and we wonder why corporate leaders have no credibility and why most corporate cultures are operating far below their level of potential. It's at least
yeah,
some of the reasons.
Exactly. And why there's so much dissatisfaction in the corporate culture itself, and turnover rates are so high, and on and
right.
on and on. Yeah.
Right.
So the tribes themselves have cultures, and each culture has its own theme, its own sort of dominant tone and attitude towards the world and worldview itself, for that matter. So I'm going to briefly describe the five stages, then we'll go through them one at a time.
Great.
Stage one, life sucks, is at the far end of the spectrum. It's far end of the bell curve, so not too many people there. We see that mostly in addictions, criminal activity, and so on. It's about 2% of the corporate population is at stage one, and it's street gangs, shotgun culture, hostile clan, life's a bad deal, alienated from the company and others, and driven, if anything, by just survival drives.
Right.
Stage two, my life sucks, is actually a step up because it also implies that life can work for other people. So it's a bit of an upswing here. It can work for other people, although my life still sucks. Surprisingly large, 25% of corporate culture is at stage two. And this is, you know, probably one of the biggest drags on companies there is. It's apathetic. The employees behave like apathetic victims, and there's hostility, sort of things that we connect with the post office, the Department of Motor Vehicles, that type of attitude. They feel disconnected from the company, no passion, no accountability,
mm-hmm.
and giving up is the only thing to do. Nothing works. Stage three, I'm great, but obviously the implication, you're not. And most people sort of top out here. About 49% of the corporate culture is here. doctors, professors, salespeople, lawyers, many of those have a team, but the team is always working just for them. And it's not that the team is great, it's just that the particular individual is great, and the team is there to serve that individual. Knowledge is power, sort of the lone warrior mentality. Wants individual accomplishment, wants individual excellence. Winning is probably its one of its biggest value. Bestsellers still prevalent in most higher education.
Mm-hmm.
It's enthusiastic but egocentric, and very rarely a team player. And so it's a pretty common type. Stage 3 in the integral model is orange altitude, and stage 4 is green altitude. And it's, we're great. But then there's also the implication in the background, and they're not. But about 22% of the corporate culture reaches stage 4, which is, in a sense, sort of the highest that one can realistically hope for in a corporate culture today, although we are seeing the slow emergence of an even higher stage, stage 5,
mm-hmm.
where life is great. But stage 4 has so many advantages over the first three stages that it certainly sort of emerges as a bit of the hero of this tale. Certainly getting a company into stage 4 is going to give it enormous advantages over stage 1, 2, or 3. All people are treated as equal individuals. There's a tribal pride. It's vision and values driven. The teams are the norm. They have a shared purpose and goal. A person at this stage talks we language and not me or I language. And their most common relationship, unlike stage 3, which is most common relationship, is the dyad, in which the one person, the stage 3 person, is the winner, the implicit winner in this dyad. Stage 4 is in triads. And helping individuals move from dyads to triads is important, an important part of the relationships that tend to define stage 4. About 22% of the population at stage 4, which incidentally gels with about the percentage of the population that's at green or pluralistic or postmodern stages in population at large. And then stage 5, life is great. And this is so clearly a radically integral and all-inclusive level. It has global, all-inclusive values and drives. It talks values, but it's not even our values. It's universal values, what you also call resonant values.
Mm-hmm.
Miraculous innovations in ever-growing networks. They will talk competition, but it's really a limitless potential, and it's for the good of all humankind. Very little fear, very little stress. In a sense, it's just like stage 4, only there's no others.
Yeah.
So it's because it's just all inclusive. So most companies, they average out to around stage 2.5. And most are at stage 2, 3, or 4, but the average is about 2.5. And company cultures can shift by working on these two leverage points in particular, by changing the words that people use and changing the type of relationships that they engage in. And so with that, we sort of get into a hands-on. The prep work, in a sense, for a tribal leader, for somebody who wants to become at least a stage 4 tribal leader, is that they know all the levels and their characteristics. In their company, they know who is at what stage. The language, the values, the relationships. They work on themselves to have a center of gravity at stage 4.
Right.
And they have a stage 4 support network. And then what's so interesting is the research that you did suggesting that leaders can upgrade most groups by one full stage in 90 days.
Right.
So that's very cool, very good news. What's starting to happen is that developmental studies are sort of slowly working their way back into psychology departments and education departments and so on. We went through a whole period where, in the last two decades, where postmodernism basically just devastated developmental studies because they were working with, you know, levels and ranking and hierarchies and all these things that are supposed to be bad terms to postmodernism, because postmodernism doesn't make a distinction between actualization hierarchies and dominator hierarchies.
Right.
And they threw both of them out.
Right.
And this is clearly an actualization hierarchy. The higher you get on this hierarchy, the less likely you are to oppress somebody. The more inclusive you become, the less marginalizing you become.
Right.
So these are good things, not bad things, and people need to understand that, you know, right at the beginning.
Right.
So now we run through the stages, and this is the particularly interesting points because it's ways to use leverage points to help individuals and companies upgrade a level. And individuals can also use this in their own case. They can use this as a map of their own terrain and use the coaching and guideline suggestions for improving their own psychological profile, if you will.
Right.
That starts at stage one. Life sucks, which is just despairing hostility, a kind of anything goes, morality, gangs, criminals, dejected losers, life sucks, it's unfair, it's pointless, it's valueless. So, I mean, it's crimes, drugs, whatever works. It really is just kind of being in the pits. But we do see it with addictions and crime and so on. So it is down there, and it is having an impact on companies, corporations. So it is something that needs to, you know, be taken into account. The suggestions here in particular are to substitute the language of stage two for stage one. And, of course, that's kind of a general rule for any developmental sequence, but it's particularly important here. And so getting an individual to see that my life sucks, but not all life sucks. There are things that do work. And then look for the ways that these people are successful and point that out to them so that they can see that there is, you know, hope somewhere. And as a matter of fact, there's hope in their own life.
Yeah, and if I could just insert one thing. One thing we probably didn't emphasize enough in the book but really should have about stage one is the reason this is such a problem globally is not so much the inner city phenomenon but more what we're seeing in disaffected areas around the world where children grow up without any sense of a future that calls to them in any meaningful way.
Right.
And so life is just a despairing sort of place, and
right.
So people resort to very, you know, simplistic cause and effect mechanisms to make any sort of impact. And so one of the big problems that we're dealing with is, you know, people who strap exploding underwear to their bodies and try to blow up a plane.
Right.
So that's a direct outgrowth of stage one.
Right.
And you know, the interesting thing in talking with corporate leaders about stage one, they usually don't get it. You know, they don't see it. They don't think it's a problem. And the percentages that you went off are, from our studies, in employed situations. So we're not making arguments here about that these are the levels societally.
Right.
Or these are the levels that you see in employed situations. And the number's about 2% in stage one, so very
right.
low. But yet, when you think about the concerns that as a world we're dealing with, stage one is one of the highest issues.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I wanted to sneak that in.
Yeah, exactly. So it definitely bears, you know, watching and working with and is, you know, in its own way, a very important stage.
Well, it is. And we identified a couple different types or subcategories within stage one. One is probably typified by the kid you might remember who shot up Virginia Tech. And he was literally a person without a tribe. He had systematically severed his contact. So he was a social isolate. And then when you couple that kind of social isolation with any sort of mental illness or fantasies that get out of hand, you know, Ken, if your fantasies got out of hand or mine did, people in our lives, people in our tribes, would inject us in some kind of an intervention.
Right.
And in the case of a social isolate, those things run unchecked.
Right.
So that's one form. And then the other form is just this group or tribal hopelessness that sets in. And they play out in very similar ways, but they're two very different kind of subclassifications of stage one.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's an important point. And particularly also, you know, for parents watching this track along, is, you know, pretty important. One of the recommendations for helping somebody out of stage one is that they just cut all relationships with other stage one people.
Right.
Because the influence that tribes have are so important. And studies consistently show in developmental psychology that it's the relationship that young kids have with their peer group,
right,
which turns out to be the single largest dominant factor in their behavior.
And that's one of the reasons we're such big fans of groups like the Boys and Girls Clubs of
right.
America,
right.
Where the intervention is literally change your tribe.
Right.
And so you get a child at risk who walks in, and you know, and suddenly they become a different person. And it,
right.
And I'm sure you've seen some of the recent studies coming out of the Connected series, but it is just amazing how people take on the social and even the physical attributes of their tribe. In some
right.
cases, one or two people removed.
Right.
So if my friend has a friend who starts smoking, my chances of starting smoking go up.
Yeah.
It's just wild how that
it
works.
It is. Yeah. The degrees of separation phenomena is really astonishing, and it really does go to show the power of this sort of inner subjective network and
yeah.
networks that we're all plunged into, you know, irredeemably.
It is. And now, if we want to take this a bit deeper, and if I'm taking it in a direction you don't want, please just just guide me back. So the deeper version of this, and the people who are listening to this will, I'm sure, want the deeper version, is we're really measuring something that is invisible, that cannot be measured. So we're not – now, we in measurement, of course, you have to measure that which can be measured. So that which can be measured is the structure of relationships.
Right.
And you can measure the words that come out of people's mouth that describe
right.
themselves and each other and the work that people do.
Right.
But what we're really reaching for, in the same way you can't measure self-actualization, you can
right.
measure the manifestation of it, but you can't measure it directly. You can't measure the what's called the deterministic screen, the
right.
the word the net or web of terms built in a systematic relationship in one's head.
Right.
You can't measure that, you know,
right.
but you can measure the words that come out, and then you can begin to make some extrapolations about likely how they see the world.
Right.
So in the case of stage one, any sense of I have a role to play, or there's something that I can do about the greater issues that I see in the world. And this is a very difficult, you know, concept for people who've grown up with opportunity to get. But
yeah.
those thoughts are literally impossible. They're
yeah.
irreconcilable with the deterministic screen that's going on in people's minds.
Yeah, which is just, like you say, it's for a lot of people listening, it's hard for them to imagine. But, you know, try to imagine it. And if you can, it's a devastating world.
It is.
It is an absolutely bleak, nothing works. Why am I here? You know, might as well throw myself off the bridge type of atmosphere.
Right.
And gruesome.
Yeah. Or strap a bomb to myself. Or
sure.
Or hang out in the corners and, you know, and do drugs. And
right.
and since we're talking about your tribal cultures, we're not talking about the level of one's own psychological development. There's obviously
right.
a relationship between those, but we're not talking about that.
Right.
We've seen examples of people that are clearly much more advanced in their own development regress to stage one because of a situational issue. For example, it's very common. One of my roles is I'm a professor at USC in the business school, and I have students do cases on their companies. These are all executives. These are not,
right.
you know, these are not undergraduates or people just getting their full-time MBA. And often there'll be a little note about, well, in this one part of the company, I uncovered some accounting malfeasance, and it looks like it was purposeful.
Yeah.
And usually there's kind of a throwaway comment like that.
Yeah.
And I always write in the edge when I see that comment, that's evidence of stage one. And stage one doesn't happen, at least rarely happens, in isolation. So
right.
so that's like a cancer that's
right.
growing in your company.
Right.
And if you found that, it's likely metastasized.
Right.
And it's likely gone far beyond anything that you can see evidence for.
Yeah.
And in many cases, they come back and say, no, we there's a couple bad apples, we got rid of them, and we're done. It's very common for those for those students to, in many cases, the owners of the companies or the CEO,
yeah.
to write back and say, you know, a year after they get their degree, you know, you were right, we're in bankruptcy, I had no idea, half our company was legal fiction.
Yeah.
And then when you kind of probe into it, it was people acting out of the sense of, there is nothing I can do.
Right.
Life is unfair, has handed me a, you know, crappy deal.
Right.
And so I'm going to do whatever it takes for me to survive and not personally get killed.
Right. And somebody in the organization, somebody working with this person, has more likely than not at one point or another shared their, you know, similar worldview in a kind of a tested out way.
Right.
And when the other person agrees, then they're like, yeah, fuck it. I didn't even add this up, right? I don't give a rat's ass, you know, da, da, da. And so they actually know what's going on. There's an actual, you know, tribe running this thing. And so, like you say, when you find one person doing it, it's rarely one person. It's not one you know, bad apple spoils the barrel. It's not a good metaphor. It's more like one rotten root system, and you've got a whole
right.
root system rotten throughout the thing.
Yeah.
So it certainly should be, even though it's listed as a, you know, quote, minor 2%, when you find it, it can be devastating. And so it's, in a certain way, it's all the more important to keep an eye out for that type of thing.
Yeah.
And then when somebody moves from stage one to stage two, they likely kind of move from the sort of alienated act of hostility of stage one to the sort of passive apathy of stage two, which can look like they're going backwards.
Right.
But it's actually a move up.
Right. It's, again, since we're talking, you know, tribal dynamics here, not individual dynamics. And,
right.
And Ken, as you mentioned when you and I talked at your loft, wow, it was several years ago now,
yeah.
you know, you mentioned, and I would agree with you, that if we were talking about one's individual development, stage one and even stage two are really dysfunctional forms of something else.
Right.
And it's a controversial conclusion, but
right.
the reason we think it's a legitimate stage is that we saw evidence that people, or again, groups, would move through these.
Right.
And so it's common to have a tribe where one individual, you know, sort of gets out of the situation at risk, and then they'll go back and recruit another member, two or three.
Right.
And then so sort of the tribe has moved to stage two.
Right.
As my colleague John likes to say, there's something that people have to give up as they move from one stage to another. So there's both an opportunity that you seize by moving forward, but there's also a subtraction effect. And the subtraction is that, you know, there's an immediate spontaneity, almost a kind of I mean, it's a viciousness, but there can be a joy in it, too, of stage one. We interviewed, this is one example, one very, at the time, very successful artist. And he was a young man, newly married, I'm not certain he was married, but he has a child with his either wife or girlfriend.
Right.
And he would go on these binges where he would do all sorts of drugs. And somewhere in the kind of coming out of it, he would produce these works of art that were absolutely magnificent.
Yeah.
Passion and completely untrained, but the rawness of it is what made it work.
Right.
And then he'd come out of it, and of course his wife would have kicked him out, and so
right.
he'd perhaps, you know, literally in the gutter. So then he'd suck it up, and he'd go get a job at a place like Starbucks, and it
yeah.
was, you know, and his life would suck.
Yeah.
And so looking at it from the outside, he's lost his fire, he's lost his passion, he's lost his vibrancy, and looks very despondent. So we heard from parents who had children who went to the Boys and Girls Club, and they thought somehow their kids were being brainwashed because
yeah.
they used to be, you know, so alive.
Yeah.
And now they walk in the Boys and Girls Club and they say, you know, my life sucks. And there's nothing
yeah.
to do here.
Yeah.
You know, I got to, you know, check my gun at the door. I mean, I don't yeah. know anybody.
Yeah.
So that's a very important point, that stage two can feel, you know, the inner subjectivity of it can feel like a regression.
Right.
It can look like a regression from the outside.
Right.
I believe it actually is a step forward.
Yeah. And it is, you know, it's just an interesting factor. And it was one of the first things I noticed about your data, which you just commented on, which is that the first two stages looked like, you know, a sick version of something else, of some other stage.
Mm-hmm.
Generally what you find in individual development is you have these stages of development. At best, they're just sort of – they're neutral, but there's functional and dysfunctional forms of each stage.
Right.
But this just looked like, you know, two stages in a row that were nothing but dysfunctional.
Well, and so since we're moving to stage two, what makes it so, you know, exceptional – and now I got to go way out on a limb here. You know, I've been teaching management for a long time. My academic appointment is in the Department of Management.
Yeah.
And I got to say, management is largely responsible for the large amounts, you know, 25% of stage two that we see. And and people can just get a very clear image of that if they watch any television. The show The Office, the NBC show,
right.
You know, it was very popular for a number of years. There's foreign spinoffs of it. Of course, our U.S. show is a spinoff of the U.K. version. And so the question is, why is that show so popular? And the obvious answer is because people recognize it. It you know, comedy is funny because there's a recognition effect.
Right.
So that's a group at stage two. People say, you know, my life sucks and there's nothing I can do. My life is at the effect of someone who's probably not too bright. But yet all the management systems are set up to empower that person that, in fact, is creating stage two in his or her wake.
Right.
You know, and that's why we think, since we're making the argument really about organizations, that this is a stage that companies need to migrate out of.
Right.
But we have to look at what caused it in the first place. It's not that people haven't progressed more in their own development. When they leave work, they no longer talk in terms of stage two.
Yeah.
So this is not where we have to kind of go in and do individual interventions.
Yeah.
This is a situation where circumstantially, people are not set up to win, and when they offer ideas, it usually comes down to a question of who has more horsepower in things like politics and interpersonal power.
Right.
So people lose, and they just, you know, shrug their shoulders and say, "I'm not going to do this."
Yeah, that's such an important finding, because, you know, as you point out, when they get away from the company, they generally revert to whatever it is their individual stage of development is at, which actually might be rather healthy.
Yes.
And it might be unhealthy, but the point is, it's not necessarily my life sucks.
Right.
Whereas more often than not, that is the stage that you're going to find in companies, at least in this culture at this particular time. And so
right.
It's telling us that there's some dynamic embedded in cultural management
right.
that is just dysfunctional.
It is.
And that is something that really needs to be looked at, because it's either something that is mandatory in group association. It's just people get together and they automatically move into, when they first do it, they're automatically in these very dysfunctional, my life sucks or our life sucks or most everybody's life sucks. It's either something inherent in it, or it's just something that the organization is unnecessarily doing
right.
to do this. And it certainly strikes me as it's something that it's probably unnecessarily doing, especially since these people aren't inherently
right.
at a, you know, my life sucks stage.
Well, and that's exactly right. And we have to keep in mind that management as we know it, all as Gary Hamel likes to say, if you walk in the CEO's office of just about any large corporation, it's kind of like walking in the cockpit of a jet. And it doesn't really matter if it's a Boeing 777 or a Dreamliner or a Cessna. You're going to see a lot of familiar things, right? There'll
right.
be an organization chart, and there will be what are called decision rights, how we allow people to make certain decisions or not, how we hold them accountable, how we reward them. There are all of these systems, right?
Right.
And as Gary points out in his book, The Future of Management, these all evolved. That's probably not the right word. These were invented in a very short period of time, not long ago, mostly
right.
coming out of Detroit, out
right.
of General Motors, people like Alfred Sloan.
Yeah.
And so today, those of us that are involved in the running of organizations look at those as being as preordained as the solar system.
Right.
But they're very recent inventions, and they're inventions that were made prior to the Drucker knowledge revolution.
Right.
And so really these are legacies
right.
from the past. And when you look at the best run organizations, places like Zappos or Google or aspects of Microsoft, and again, we're talking tribes here, we're not talking whole companies,
right.
you find that by and large they don't manage in those classic ways at all.
Right.
And as a result, they don't have the large tails of stage two, people
right.
just feeling disaffected and like they can't do anything.
Yeah, it really does seem that what we've got here is a real anachronism. We've got a management system designed, you know, anywhere from recently going all the way back to the Industrial Revolution. It's kind of an assembly line, mechanical, clunk and grind view of management, and it certainly doesn't take people's interiors into account.
Right.
And then we had the revolution of the 60s, where it's all about interiors and, you know, how are you feeling and
Right.
What matters to you and what's your value system and so on. And we've got a management system that's completely blind to that. And so the early stages of a company's development, if they're going to be headed up by that kind of out-of-date, blind, clunky management, that's the first place that we would look
right.
for what's going wrong here.
Oh, exactly. And then the question you have to ask is, well, then what's the purpose of management? I mean, someone must be getting something because management persists. And a lot of people haven't really thought deeply about it. And I should, you know, mention I'm a huge fan of the free market. I'm one of the reasons that I continue to consult for businesses and do work in a business school, and business school that I'm very proud of, is that business has enormous potential.
Right.
And traveling around the world, more so than governments, more so than
right.
peace movements or grassroots movements, business runs the world. And most people in business, because they're just people, are well-intentioned. They want to do the right thing. And many of them have just inherited this system of thinking that, you know, that was around long before their birth.
Right.
And they don't realize that actually they're accomplishing the opposite of what they intend.
Right.
So what everybody in business wants, everybody, is the business to run well, to turn out products and services that are helpful, to not devastate or damage the economy in some way,
right.
to have employees that are satisfied and contributing and feel that they're making an impact, because those will be people who contribute not just muscle on a rivet machine,
right.
but also ideas. So everyone wants the same thing, but yet we're hindered by these old ways of thinking that we're not even questioning.
It's so astonishing to see that happening too, because business, one of the things that it's adjusted for is to adapt fairly quickly to changing market conditions. I mean, that's after all how you stay in business. And so there's at least some part of business management and leadership that has its eyes and ears out for any changes. But it seems to be sort of pathologically stuck to simply noticing changes in the exterior market environment and not noticing changes in the interior, which is where this real revolution has occurred.
You know, and you used an interesting word at the end of that sentence, revolution. As I understand the story, I've heard this from a number of sources and read some of the primary sources. There was a point where Alfred Sloan was called before Congress when it became clear that the U.S. automakers were doing so well. It sounds like a strange thing to say now. And the question that was put to him is what would it take for every company in the United States to be as successful as, you know, as these companies have become?
Right.
And his line was, it would require a mental revolution in the United States.
Yeah.
And looking at it from his side, of course, that looked like an almost insurmountable problem.
Right.
Well, that mental revolution has come and has gone.
Right.
And it's gone into the history books so quickly that many of us don't even realize that it ever happened.
Right.
It just seems like the way it is today. Right.
Right. Right.
And so what really stands before leaders to do is to not just look at the culture, but look at the reason, you know, behind it. I love sending people through Zappos, this little company in Henderson that makes they sell shoes and other products over the internet.
Right.
And they are not managed the way that you would manage a company, and people come out and their eyes are just about to burst out of their heads. You know, and they say, I could never in my company do what they do. And my
right.
answer is, you're right. But here's what they do. They figured out what is important to them, what values they have,
right.
and they took out, you know, the weed whacker to anything that was inconsistent with those values, including
right.
everything we take for granted about how you run a company.
Right.
They just cut it all down.
Right.
So that what results is it looks kind of like, you know, it's the weeds are grown out of control, but the weeds in this case are growth and creativity, spontaneity, initiative. I mean, they can solve problems in an afternoon at Zappos that General Motors won't be able to solve in a decade.
You know, it's so funny. It's almost like the revolution of the 60s
mm-hmm.
came and went. So much of these companies have characteristics that sound like psychological profiles of a standard pluralistic stage, green stage, postmodern stage development person.
Right.
You know, egalitarian and networked and working for fairness, and values are more important than money, and, you know, spontaneity and fun is more important than drudge and efficiency and so on. And it's like, you know, about 23, 24% of the population is at green, is at pluralistic, is at this altitude. And yet the rest just sort of came and went. And it's like it just didn't stick. And it's always been so surprising to me, particularly for boomers who were so, you know, loudmouthed and sort of pig-headed, if you will, about getting their way done. I go, yeah, well, why didn't you do it in business? Why didn't you, didn't do it in love? It's really an interesting phenomenon.
It's fascinating.
But you're right. It's like a revolution came and went, and we missed it.
Well, and at least, I can't speak to the love angle, but in terms of business, as you've and I think you've been probably the most artful proponent of this view that the problem with pluralism, there's always a design flaw in every one of the the elevation points. The design flaw in green is that what used to work in the old system you now reject. So if it's kind of white male, then it's sort of bad.
Right.
But you accept everything else. You're accepting of everything except that from which you just came from.
Right.
And in business, what the financial markets demand, so now we're talking about Wall Street, the investor community, what's called the great pool of money, globally, what it demands is predictability.
Right.
It doesn't demand growth. Now, it wants growth, but what it demands is predictability.
Right.
And so the way you get predictability is you tell people what to do. So you default into an orange system, which is why management tends to be stage three, and then people who are at the effect of it tend to regress to stage two, saying, my life sucks, I'm at the effect of this.
Right.
Meanwhile, in their other lives, they may express kind of a green point of view, but green was never consistent with how companies could be run, unless they're privately held, not accountable to Wall Street or not accountable to some broader investor community.
Uh-huh.
Many of those companies, many of them are small, they're entrepreneurial, they're growing, don't have layers of bureaucracy, were able to move into what we call stage four and have their momentary shot from time to time into stage five.
Right.
But to find a publicly traded company that has even a majority of its tribes at stage four is almost impossible.
Wow. Well, that certainly makes sense, and I think it accounts for a whole lot of, otherwise weird things that were, hard to account for. And it certainly makes sense to me. Now what we want to see is if there are other ways that stage four culture can be gotten into business. And obviously, consultants like you and a handful of others, that's what they're working for.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also just the sheer, if nothing else, the sheer rationality of the data and of, studies that just, if there's ever a study shown on development and leadership, they all show the same basic thing. The higher the level of development, the greater the rankings and leadership capability.
Right.
And so, if nothing else, there's a reason to get with this type of picture and to get with this type of unfolding.
Yeah, exactly. And just, my own story, this might be interesting to some of your readers. When I first met John, this is now probably 15, years ago, he'd been strongly influenced by the Graves model and a number of other things. And he and I used to have these knockdown, drag-out fights, not literally. We'd have them over at Santa Monica, a lot there, famous latte chats. But John was talking about what he had found in working with organizations and, coming from kind of the business school model and getting my PhD in a related field, I would tell him every reason he was wrong. And, finally, I just had to admit sort of the, no pun intended, bankruptcy of my own, of my own field, that it's produced the opposite of what it's intended to produce.
Right.
In so much of a kind of mindless way. I'm interviewed a lot, as I know you are, and I was on one of the big networks not too long ago, and the question was, how do you change the culture of Wall Street? I mean, really, just how do you do it? Since we all agree that the culture is at least part of the problem.
Right.
Well, okay, to begin with, let's recognize that the top of the mountain in most Wall Street firms is stage three.
Right.
What was your bonus last year? You only did $20 million. Wow, you suck, man. I did 50.
Yeah, yeah.
So then the person thinks, well, wow, what do I have to do? What do I have to externalize? That's a business term.
Right.
In order to get 55 so I can be better than that.
Yeah, exactly.
And then we get a whole, group of people in their wake that just kind of does what they're told to do.
Right.
And then we get an SEC that largely has the culture of stage two. We're
right.
not given enough resources. We're too bureaucratic. We're, if we ever step out and, you know, really investigated this Madoff guy, some senator, somebody
right.
important shut us down.
Right. Right.
So we get all the regulatory groups at stage two, which means they're completely ineffective.
Right.
So this really dysfunctional, I'm great, get out of my way, you're an idiot,
right.
runs unabated.
Yeah.
And we're all paying the cost of that right
yeah.
now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And it's such a mutual congratulation society, you know, the company of higher leadership, that they don't do what they would do otherwise in their company, which is look at their own behavior and say,
right.
is any part of this broken? Can it be fixed? Let me look at it ahead of time. What do you think? They don't even question it. That's not even on the agenda.
Right.
Whereas anybody coming in and you know, looking at the company taking a view from 10,000 feet, one of the first things they would see is management's philosophy, management's worldview is fucked.
Yeah.
And you guys are just really, you know, heading the charge into dysfunctional city and dragging ethics down and, you know, everything else. But just strangely, that hasn't happened to nearly to the degree that, you know, we would think would be healthy.
Well, and it's shocking because it's really an everybody wins argument. You know,
well, that's what I was saying earlier. Can't they even rationally read a spreadsheet? I mean,
well, one friend you and I have in common is a person named Eben Pagan.
Yeah.
And so Eben's been getting on my case and rightfully so, and on John's case and Haley's case too, that when you make an argument that if you do X, everything in your life gets better. You know, you lose weight and your sex drive increases and you become taller and your car becomes cooler and all that stuff, then you're essentially making an argument that nobody can kind of, there's no mental category that it falls in. And so that's probably our bad for not making it really clear.
Right.
But, you know, so what we've been focusing on lately is if you want, you know, figure out what you want. If it's innovation, if it's profitability, if it's a nonprofit, then, you know, you're probably interested in social good in ways that are measurable. But figure out what it is you really want. Okay.
Right.
Focus on that. Whatever that is, you will get somewhere between 300 and 500% more of it.
Right.
If whatever tribes run your organization move to the next stage culturally,
right. Right.
Period.
Right.
Yeah, that becomes, you know, really, really powerful for people.
Right.
What I just always laugh at is in a number of companies where we've done these interventions and we get, remember, we're talking tribes here, we're not talking
right.
companies. So we'll get a little group, usually a little out of the fray, a little out of the kind of public swirl of what people pay attention to, that'll get their act together. And John is a master at doing this, and he'll get these little groups up to stage, you know, four, thresholding stage five.
Yeah. Yeah.
So all of their numbers move up. And there'll be the naysayers, you know, typically operating out of a stage three, kind of, I'm great, you're not vocabulary.
Right.
And they'll say things like, they've got to be cooking the books over there. There's no way that group of lame people, because, you know, we've got Harvard MBAs and, you know, they went to some place I've never heard of. There's no way they can be making that kind of money. And furthermore, it's a mess because they're always talking and they're, you know, they're not working the phones or it's not orderly, right? So we need to take the guy out who's running that and we need to put in a real, you know, manager. And, of course, the minute you do that, you regress the culture to stage three. The results fall apart and you say, yep, you know, I knew that guy was cooking the books.
Oh, Lord. Well, yeah, welcome to the real world, guys. There's something going on here.